kurie buvo pirmam, taip pirmą paskaitą, tie patys, kad pasirodė antropo skaito, bet jau dėl manų žmonių. Aš jums pristatau Jean-Paul Petit-Tambert, naujosios kartos semantiką, kuris skirtingai nuo Landovskio visiškai nėra žinomas Lietuvoje, bet semiotikų žurnale Aksemiotik, kuriame yra nemažai kitos straipsnių, jis yra vienas produktyviausių autorių. Ir aš dabar nežinau, ar ten galima ne tik prancūzų kalbą perskaityti jų tekstų, šiaip jisai rašo apie anglų kalbą, tai bent jau internete gal galima surasti ir anglų kalbą jų tekstų, nes kaip matysite, mano manimas jau laisvai valdo anglų kalbą, todėl kad pats pirmasis jo išsilavinimas, niekas negimsta ir semiotikais ir niekas dažniausiai savo pirmojo išsilavinimo nebūna semiotikais, ypač vyresnės kartos žmonių, tai jis savo pirmojo išsilavinimo buvo anglistas, vėliau studijavo komercinį aukštojo mokykloje ir tapo marketingo specialistas ir į semiotiką atėjo gana vėlai. Iš reklamos marketingo srities. Ir kai atėjo į semiotiką, tai papuolė susidūrė ne su greimo semiotika, greimo atgyvo jis nebežinojo, bet su jau tą vadinamąją postgreiminę semiotiką. Ir jį labiausiai sužavėjo Eriko Landovskio semiotika ir jis yra galima būtų sakyti sociosemiotikos, tos greiminės sociosemiotikos. Kaip čia pasakyti, ištikimiausias šalininkas. Kita vertus, jis turėtų būti daug kam įdomus tuo, kad tai yra labai intensyviai praktikuojantis semantikas. Jeigu toj pasgreiniai semantikai nemažai yra tokių, kurie yra teoretizuojantis ir vis naujus modelius kūrintis semantikai, tai Petit-Tamberas yra tas, kuris praktikuoja semantiką ir kūrybiškai praktikuoja semantiką ir įvairiausiose srityse, tai ne tik marketingo. Iš marketingo srities jisai pragyvena, bet jis taip pat mėgina taikyti semantiką visiškai kitoms sritim, kuriuose tai irgi mažai taikyta semantika, tai tarkime teologijos srity, religijos srity. Žodžiu, jis yra semantikas praktikas ir kūrybingas praktikas ir manau, kad jūs to įsitikinsite klausydamiesi šio pranešimo. Jis kalbės angliškai, bet gali kalbėti prancūziškai, kas norės.
Sorry. Good morning to all. Thank you for being so many to listen to what I have to say this morning. Basically, this contribution is about the notion of emptiness, as the title reads, but a certain understanding of this concept and how this concept can acquire in communication in general, but also in marketing and in product design, a certain value. So in order to do so, I will mostly rely on an example that originates from Japan. It's a global example, but it originates from Japan. It's the Muji brand. So I will explain later on what Muji is about. But basically, what I will endeavor to do is sharing how the interactional model that those of you who attended Eric Landowski's presentation yesterday know now, and how this the model can account for the value of emptiness, and how the regime of adjustment is a key to understanding how emptiness can lead consumers to make sense of what is offered to them to be beheld or to be used, as well as how it has somehow turned it has turned into a brand philosophy, Muji's philosophy, that has somehow reshuffled the old brandscape, the old marketing landscape, and the old marketing paradigm as a result. So before I get into the heart of the matter, I would like to put everything in perspective by briefly reminding us somehow paved the way for my talk. And I want to just show you a few examples of what regularly shows on the walls of our cities and what invades the space, the urban spaces in which most of us live. So this is very briefly, this is an example from the UK. It's for a brand, for a retailer called Tesco. It's a chain of supermarkets. This other poster is from the US, it's for Aches. It's a brand of men grooming products. Then we have another poster from France, most certainly where I come from. It's from Perrier. And it just promotes their 150th anniversary in 2013. Then we have another one for the same brand, which just promotes, they promote themselves as sponsors of the Laurent Garros International Tennis Tournament. So, as you can see, most of these posters, most of the printed advertising that all of us are used to, has a heavy tendency to sort of lavishly occupy the space that is available to them. And this in order to sort of loudly make their commercial messages come across. As evidenced here by this mock ad, it's a mock ad for a stereotypical so-called detergent brand or pseudo detergent brand. So what is most striking is that these commercial visuals are all very what we would call busy in layman terms, and how they harness lots and lots of or a large number of verbal and non-verbal signs in order to convey their messages. So technically this would be called, could be called saturation, but the saturation in another exceptional meaning from what Eric mentioned yesterday, but it's spatial saturation. It would be the technical term to describe this expressive phenomenon. Now, the question is, semiotically speaking, what can we say in a broad brush way about this type of advertising? So those of you who were here yesterday have listened to Eric's explanations about his interactional socio-semiotic model. So we have here a representation of this model with its four or various regimes of interaction. So we can find manipulation, programming, adjustment, and what he called ascent, and that here is indicated as accident because it is the ascent to the accident, ascent to whatever happens. But this model is not only a model about regimes of interactions, it's also a model about regimes of meaning or regimes of significance and regimes of risk. So we have three levels in each corner of the model. So I'm not really going to dwell on this model, but I will rather use it across my talk as a lens through which we'll be looking at the various advertising and marketing practices that I have chosen as my topic today. So it will not come as a surprise to anybody, I suppose, if I first describe what I've just shown you as being first and foremost the expression, manifestation of a highly manipulative enterprise. And indeed, as you all know, the name of the game in marketing discourse is obviously to influence the prospective customer and to make them aspire to own, possess, acquire the items that manufacturers produce and distribute on the market, and of course promoting their advertising campaigns. Just to underpin this statement about the manipulative nature of advertising, I just want to show you some of the tools that are used behind the scenes by ad men. One of these tools is this type of document that is under over the generation of such campaigns. Technically, it's called a copy strategy in the jargon of the profession. And it's, as you can see, it's composed of several pre-prepared boxes that the strategist just needs to fill. So it starts with the objective of the campaign, that is in fact the formulation of the intention of the center manipulator to influence the market, to influence the seeking subject. The next box is the target audience, it is the description of this subject. It's the persona of a typical consumer that the advertising is supposed to attract. It is followed by the insight, what they call the insight, into the assumed needs or wants or desires of this stereotypical target consumer. Then it is followed by the brand promise, which defines the object of value to which the sender offers the subject to be controlled. And this commitment is really the heart of the message, the advertising message. It is then substantiated by some sort of compelling argument or supporting evidence, which is supposed to render the promise credible and make, of course, the receiving subject buy into it and start its quest. And the proposition is finally encapsulated in some sort of zingy advertising slogan. So in standard semiotic narrative analysis, we could call this a contract, just as simple as that. Now, on top of being manipulators, advertising people or advertising strategists are also operators. That is to say, they are more precisely, they are programmers. And indeed, those in charge of strategy in advertising agencies are called planners. And the main reason for this job title is the fact that their mission rightly consists in planning programs. That is to say, planning sequences of effects that the advertising should cause amongst the target audience. This is what they call the expected consumer response to the advertising. And as predicted, so to speak, by the interactional model, such an overtly manipulative vision of advertising leads to a visage that it should conform to plans. That is to say, comply with pre-prepared linear algorithms, which are made of causes and effects. So, very briefly, this chart shows several of these various algorithms used by the strategic partners in the advertising industry. We have five of them here, but all of them, or each of them, is based on the trichotomy of steps that you can, that shows in red on the left-hand side of the slide, learn, feel, do, which respectively define the cognitive, affective, and behavioral stages expected to happen with the receivers. But in this case, each of these five models give a different detailed content for the steps in which the effects of the advertising should happen. Now, certain agencies have refined this programmatic equipment further by playing the three-card trick with the order in which the sequence of steps should happen. For instance, here we have a model defined by one agency called SCB, stating that there is not a single universally working hierarchy of effects, and instead the order of learn, feel, do will depend on the type of purchase, i.e. be it rational or emotional, and the level of involvement of the consumer in the product category. For instance, paper towels trigger very low involvement and are not very much linked to feelings. On the contrary, a sports car, a Ferrari, is a feeling product and has a high involvement. So they have come up with four different algorithms that show here in red squares, and four corresponding types of advertising, so informative, effective, and so on and so forth. So to cut a long story short, from an international standpoint, we can firmly state that the standard advertising, that is advertising as we know it, is firmly grounded in what the theory, the socio-semiotic theory, describes as the constellation of prudence. It is in essence both manipulative and problematic. Now, we, having that in mind, we can get into the heart of the matter and see what advertising ATS looks like. In order to do so, as I heralded at the beginning of my talk, I will illustrate it with the example of a Muji plant. But assuming that not many of you are familiar with this plant, I will probably need to give you a few information about this plant. It's a very successful, thriving Japanese retail company that was founded in the 1980s and which sells a wide variety of household and consumer goods. They manufacture themselves, they design and manufacture and sell them to themselves. They claim to be a total lifestyle company or a total lifestyle brand that sells clothing, homeware, cosmetics, furniture, kitchen appliances, tableware, etc., etc., etc. They all design and manufacture themselves all these products. They can be found in 900 shops around the world. Unfortunately, they have not reached Lithuania yet, but they will probably shortly. And their product catalogue comprises more than 7,000 items. Their full name, Mujiu Yomin, translates into no label good products, or if you will, in better English, unbranded quality goods. In spite of this no label ethos, Muji has a very significant brand recognition amongst consumers and professionals. Now, let me just say that this brand has nothing to do with the subvertising movement or the anti-globalization movement, or, for instance, the movement that was started in 2000 when Owen Klein, the American journalist, published her book, No Label. This has nothing to do with it, because it's a very capitalistic enterprise, and they make a lot of profit. This is what their products look like. So this is just a few samples of the products. Globally, overall, these products are sort of streamlined, minimalistic, almost generic products. Now, having that in mind, we can have a look at their advertising. And this is a Muji advertising poster. And in fact, it is only a close-up on about half of it. The full poster is this. This is the full poster. As opposed to what I've shown you before at the beginning of the presentation, this is a rather amazing piece of advertising. It heavily contrasts with the saturation that I mentioned at the beginning. And as you can see, there is precisely not much to see, or to look at, or to read, if we use Ostis terminology, which differentiates reading from grasping as two different ways to access to the significance of an object. So, basically, it's composed of, number one, a very distant skyline and a vast, empty spatial area or landscape. Just for your information, this picture was shot in Bolivia at the Uyuni Salt Lake. And then we have, secondly, a solitary human being somewhere, which allows the beholder to get a flavor of the scale of the view. And lastly, or thirdly, a super brand logo on top, on the right-hand side of the poster. And conversely to these posters that I showed you at the beginning of the presentation, this huge poster is very big, it's 24 square meters, so 8 meters by 3. This huge poster is in fact pretty empty. It's indeed intended to represent emptiness. This is its Japanese version, so you can recognize the Muji logo written in kanji, overlapping the sky and the earth. And I will show you a few other examples of the same campaign. This is another one that was shot at the Uyuni's Salt Lake in Bolivia as well. Third one. This one and the following one were shot in Mongolia. But wherever they were shot, this is not the point. The Uyuni in the far distance,
Protestant background, are there to give a notion of the state of this empty space here. And they have the same function as the human being in the Yumi visuals. Now, there's probably no need to continue multiplying the examples here to get the point. These posters are for Muji, but they are also very reminiscent of, even analogous, we should say, to this kind of traditional Japanese visual art. This one is one of the most famous Japanese paintings. It was produced in the 16th century by a painter called Hasegawa Takako. It is green, and it represents a pine forest covered in mist. And in the general economy of a picture, the blank empty spaces are in fact much more important or instrumental for the beholder than those that are painted. They're a kind of visual device that is instrumental, as I said, in allowing the eye of the beholder to float freely across the picture. That allows or triggers his imagination. I mean, these empty black spaces invite the recipient to guess what is hidden behind these empty spaces. Where does this globally recognized Japanese idiosyncrasy come from? That's a good question. And what does it imply in symbolic terms, more importantly, when it comes to what and how it signifies? One answer to that question is given by the Shenmen. The Shenmen is called Kenyahara. He is a Muji's art director, so he's the one who designed the posters that I showed you. He's in charge of designing Muji's communication campaigns. A number of the slides I'm going to show you later on are borrowed from him, from lectures he gives regularly, in which he shares his insight into the prime principles and explains where this concept of emptiness comes from. And according to him, emptiness has a very long history in Japan. It stems from antique Chinese religious beliefs and practices. This calligraphy in kanji reads and means Shinto, and can be translated literally as the way of the gods. Shinto, or Shintoism, as we all know, is an animistic religion, and the most ancient Japanese religion, dating back from antiquity. And according to Hara, it is in this distant Japanese past that the origins of the value of emptiness can be found. Long before the Chinese introduced Buddhism to Japan, which only happened in the 6th century AD, the actual Japanese believed that wisdom can be found in nature. They also believed that everything in nature, trees, rocks, rivers, mountains, earth, clouds, everything, is possessed by spirits or gods that they call kamis. The Japanese refer to these kamis as yomyorozu no kami, which means eight living gods. That is to say that these gods are myriads of gods. So they are infinite, and more importantly, they are ubiquitous. And according to Shinto beliefs, nature being very fickle and delicate, there's no way to visit or make an appointment to these gods. So the only thing that could be done is to invite them as guests. So they invented this curious structure, which is an elementary shrine, which is still very common in Japan today. It's used in Shinto ceremonies. It's called Shiro, which means black or empty. It's made of four poles, erected in a square, with their tops joined by a straw rope. And inside this area, there is nothing. That is, it is empty. And in fact, it is emptiness made manifest or perceptible. And once the structure is created, the gods, the kamis, which see everything, cannot fail to notice, according to Shinto beliefs, of course, they cannot fail to notice this empty space. And one or two of them may come to fill it, because emptiness holds in itself the possibility to be That does not give any certainty, though, that it's, they will enter. They may enter. And this may carries great weight in their shito belief, because what people pray for is the possibility to interact with the deity, the possibility to be heard by the kami, and the possibility to be fulfilled. So people visit the shrine, and in its emptiness, they sense the potential presence of the deity. They pray and leave with a sense of having, again, potentially communed with the kami through this emptiness. To the Shinto believer, that's good enough. And this is the origin of the Japanese, certain kind of Japanese communication, according to Kenyahara. So we see that this notion of emptiness, understood as a potential receptacle for the divine, and therefore as a condition for a possible interaction with it, has taken on its meaning and value in the Japanese culture and ethos. And according to Hara, this is how this idiosyncratic amorphacui, this love of emptiness, was born and has become recognizably embedded in everything Japanese. It follows, according to Hara, that this from this specifically Japanese and Shinto valuation of the vacuum, viewed as or understood, conceptualized as a reserve of international potentialities, that this amor factory was cultivated by music. And indeed, as we saw, music communicates, or rather conveys in its communication, the notion of emptiness. Its advertising does not try to sing the praise of anything in particular. It carries no particular message. There is no precise content. Not even about the music brand itself. So the brand literally has no strategy, superception. It's not based on a creative brief, as I showed you, was the copy strategy. So there is no target, no promise, no substantiation, no reason to believe, to make a message claim, or so on and so forth. It does not propose any contract to the subject, to the receiving subject, and it does not try to trigger any particular pre-prepared algorithms like those that I showed you earlier on. So the question is, how does this unusual communication device operate, and how can it work so successfully? Because it's a global campaign, I forgot to mention, this is not only Japanese, but it's also, this campaign is used across the world, in every country where a musician has a source. Obviously, with the characteristics I've just described, this type of advertising resists the standard narrative description. There is no product, there is no objective value, and therefore there is no manipulator to give the object its value and make the recipient want it. Unlike the standard advertising practice that we very briefly, but I briefly analyzed at the beginning, Mishi's campaigns are not grounded in the principles of intentionality, nor are they based on the principle of regular causality there, but rather on the principle of availability or sensibility, we could come back around. The mechanism, so to speak, quote unquote, consists in harnessing, exploiting the potential of each interactant. The brand advert on the one hand and the recipient decoder on the other. It appeals to the sensibility of the response given by recipients to the sensible features of the advert. In other words, because it's not designed to manipulate its beholders or make them comply with prepared programs, it's really legitimate to state that this kind of advertising counts on the regime of adjustment where the sense words. Music advertising is designed to be creative and sensible, and he often describes it as an empty vessel that is ready to be filled by whatever the recipient come up with. That's to say that the advertising has the potential to trigger its beholders to draw on their potential resources, creative resources, to make sense of whatever each of them feels music to be. And because, according to Hara, it's also designed as a receptacle, the advertising equally has the potential to accommodate the outcome of this process. As a matter of fact, for Gucci, the success of a campaign is not measured by the correct reception of the message by the audience, but rather by its ability to conjure up a multiplicity of images in their minds. So the advertising value of this visual MTS is that the vacant spaces that are displayed in the posters offer a sort of endless potential of receptive capacity. This understanding of the concept of MTS in advertising makes it a stance, a readiness to receive an input from outside, from the consumer, from the recipient. And advertising this way is sort of analogous to posing one question to as many people as possible and being fully ready, fully prepared to accept the huge variety of answers from them. Grenas himself had noted something similar in another field, the field of evangelical parables. When he studied them, he drew, after having studied the parables, some parables of the Gospels, he drew the conclusion that the peculiarity of the parable was the transfer of responsibility to the enunciatee of the text, the receiving subject of the message, to whom it is incumbent to interpret it, to choose the right answer to the question posed by the parable. Now, amongst these very answers, if we come back to Gucci, are the following perceptions, and of course the list is not not exhaustive. Some people will view Gucci as the standard bearer of a simpler, better way of life. Many people will buy into its poetic refinement, or even believe that it represents the epitome or the quintessence of Japanese minimalistic design. A number of people will associate the brand with naturalness. They will believe that it is a responsible brand that saves global resources, that is ecologically friendly, and so on and so forth. And maybe others may just find it simply economical and low cost, because they view Gucci as a very rational brand with a rational approach to product and pricing. However, conversely to standard brands that very often rely on these brand images to create their messages in order to steer the brand image into a given direction, Gucci's communication uses none of these perceptions. Having generated them, it is also receptive to all. This means that by being so quiet, by being so silent, by being so empty, Gucci do put themselves in danger. With a machine of adjustment that Gucci chooses to implement, nothing is really safe, unlike the regime of manipulation. Nothing is sure, unlike the regime of programming. There's a high level of uncertainty attached to the regime of adjustment. It leads Gucci to run a major risk, that is, the risk of falling into its neighboring regime, that is, the regime of accident here, under the auspices of randomness. And this is precisely one of the characteristics of the regime of adjustment. adjustment as a regime of interaction and significance, leading to, according to the model, the creation of an unprecedented sense, necessarily entails to embark on its corresponding regime of risk, that is labeled in the model as insecurity. And that I personally, in other analyses, have labeled precariousness. And just as Nagoski literally puts it, adjustment is indeed, as you can read, a regime of interaction where the best can only be achieved by responsibly taking the risk of the worst, and where the mutual fulfillment of both partners borders the accident. So in case in point, if this accident happen, this is what the empty vessel should look like in the end. This kind of advertising takes a big risk from a marketing point of view, the risk of being misunderstood, or even worse, the risk of generating perplexity, that is to say, of triggering no understanding at all, leaving the beholders disconcerted, unable to precisely make sense of what they are looking at. And in that instance, the receptacle would accommodate only illiterate question marks here. These disorientated question marks will obviously be quickly replaced by negative remarks. This kind of advertising may lead recipients to think of Muji as a puzzling, esoteric, obscure brand with incomprehensible, far-fetched communication, etc., etc. And this is not only a danger in terms of brand image, as you can imagine, but it's also a high financial hazard, meaning money unwisely spent on counterproductive advertising, which in our neoliberal economies is, as you all know, a mortal sin. Falling into the regime of accidents signifies that the communication may well eventuate as meaningless to some of its recipients. This necessarily implies that despite this effort to embrace as many people as possible as we saw, this policy inevitably leads to segment beholders or segment consumers and divide them into two groups, which we will cover more in depth lately. On the one hand, you have those consumers or recipients who like to be helped, who like to be directed, who like to be told what to understand, and who are precisely those who are likely to be puzzled by this very unusual advertising. And on the other hand, you have more free-spirited, more independent-minded people who like to apprehend things by themselves, and who, on the contrary, are likely to enjoy and happily buy into this type of advertising. So, as I said, we'll come back to this dichotomy later. So, to summarize, by responsibly taking the risk responsibly taking this possible randomness and hazard into account, Muji is prepared to be endangered and give its assent to whatever happens. As a result, it is seen a very unusual communication process. Therefore, we can state that this advertising encompasses both regimes of adjustment and an accidental ascent, which is what in the model is described as the constellation of adventure, where the world of significance is much less stable and much less reassuring than in the other constellation, as in this constellation is not founded on immutable laws of society or based on contracts and instructions that simply need to be followed to the letter. And indeed, it's probably not exaggerated to say that Muji is somewhat of a of an adventurous fact. Now, this emptiness does not only apply to advertising, but also applies to product design. The thoughts, Perihara often uses or gives an enlightening example of what emptiness means in terms of product design. So I have borrowed this example to explain how it works. If we take two knives, one on the left is a Hegel's knife, it's from Germany. The other on the right is a Japanese traditional yanagiba sushi knife. And I propose to have a closer look at their respective handles. The Hegel's knife is ergonomically designed so that when you hold it, your thumb naturally finds its place, or finds a natural place to rest. And it's got a high level of what designers or ergonomists call affordance. And this affordance makes it very easy to hold and use. The object instructs you how to use it, and it instructs you what to do. Meanwhile, the handle of the yanagiba is a flat, plain wooden rod, a flat cylinder. The shape of the handle doesn't instruct you where to hold it and how to hold it. So you can hold it anywhere, anywhere you wish. This plain, unsophisticated handle can receive all the techniques of the Japanese chefs. Applied to product design is a treatise against over-engineered objects. The German knife is simple, it's as far as it is economically designed to fit the hand of the cook and to anticipate the user's script, giving the thumb a natural place to rest. But Japanese chefs prefer a much less programmed tool to hold as they want, and in that sense, the yanagiba is empty. And in Kenihara's words, a flat handle is not seen as raw or poorly crafted. And on the contrary, its perfect plainness is meant to say, you can use me whichever way suits your skills. The Japanese knife accommodates the cook's skill and not the cook's thumb. Another quotation from Kenihara: when an object is empty, it is ready to receive any image or use. And then another one: emptiness is the pursuit of ultimate freedom. So, from a semiotic standpoint, this is what we can make of those two sides. As said, the Hegel's knife is very simple, but the yanagiba is empty. Both are good for a wonderful knife, no doubt. But from an interactional standpoint, there is a crystal clear difference. One falls into the regime of programming, where you just follow the instructions, and these instructions are the same every time you use it. So it's based on regular causality. It's a programmed tool. The other knife falls into the regime of adjustment, where you have to invent your own way to hold it and are free to change it any time and improvise with it. And it's based on this other principle, which is not causality but availability. The knife is available to you and you can make yourself available to the knife. This example from Kenihara is, for those of you who know Jean Foch's work, probably very reminiscent of his brilliant analysis of the difference between two types of multitask folding knives. The Swiss Army knife on the left hand side, that he called a knife for engineers, and the Obidem knife on the right hand side, that he called the knife of pre-coders. they contrast in exactly the same way as the Hagiographos and the Gamaliva. And this is what Erich Bernkowski wrote about Schwarz's analysis of the two knives in one of his articles. I don't know if it's been translated into Lithuanian, but the French title of this article is Avoir prise, donner prise. So it's my translation into English. As he, Jean-Marc Schwarz, proceeds in the analysis of the two types of operations, those carried out respectively by a group commander with an opinion and an engineer with a Swiss Army knife, the interpretation that he proposes goes in a direction that is increasingly close to what we, Erich, a few years later, define in terms of adjustment on the one hand and in terms of program and operations on the other. And along the same line, continuing the parallel between these comparisons and differences are also highly reminiscent of Bernkowski's distinction between the two ways to make use of an object. You can either utilize an object or practice it. His definitions can be found in particular Vertu et Vertu. It's another article. And this distinction between utilize and practice leads to bring into light two broad schools or two ideologies of product design. One which posits that the designer's job is to come up with objects whose affordance has been optimized in order to make the user's life simple by complying with them. And another design school, represented by Haar, posits that the designer's job is to come up with open-ended, undetermined objects, we can call them empty. That is to say, object whose purpose remains as minimal as possible, so that the user feels himself free to creatively invent his own way to make use of them. In order to further explain what the designer's job is, Haar has invented a word, which is exformation. This neologism designates the opposite of information. Information being the traditional task of the designer, who seeks to achieve affordance in the object in order to simplify, if you will, the life of the end user. If we dwell a moment on this notion of exformation, invented by Kevin Haar, we can say that exforming an object entails to streamline it, to get rid of any frills of any extra design that other more traditional designers could be tempted to include in it. It's a careful process of elimination, subtraction, of gratuitous features and design are related to the basic function of the object. That said, the operations of exformation have a limit, of course, that the designer cannot cross. The limit that would lead to the nonsense, that is to say, which would go so far as to make the object unrecognizable and unknowable by people. Kenhara uses the phrase "make things unknown" to describe this operation. But despite this, it does not mean that exformation pursues the unintelligible. From a Plotinus perspective, if you will, this exformation entails to produce the perceptible manifestations of the generic idea of the object. So no less, no more. And in semiotic terms, exformation means for the designer to produce an object whose configurative, taxic, and functional descriptions, according to the three components that Plotinus defined three dimensions determining any object. So these three components can only be reduced to a small, irreducible set of elementary features which constitute the minimum definition into which the object belongs. The definition of the class, sorry. So if I briefly illustrate this with simplistic, very trivial examples, here we have two companions. One is designed with instructions on the left-hand side, the other one by Yuji, without any instruction on the right-hand side. The same applies to an example of exformed pattern graphic designs. It's for a product by Yuji, which contrasts, which heavily contrasts with its equivalent by Doria. Now, if we try to go a little further prior to concluding my talk, I will try to synthesize what we have analyzed so far. This is a visualization of Gellner's definition of a sign with its two planes, but more importantly with its two strata per plane, the stratum of substances and the stratum of the invariable forms. Jean-Louis Floch often harnessed this definition of a sign, Gellner's definition of a sign, and adapted it in the context of his plant analysis. For Floch, the substance of content of a gram consists of the conceptual universes in which the blood operates. In other words, the substance of content covers the business sectors, the product categories, the markets or market segments in which the gram manifests itself. The substance of expression of a gram refers to the techniques, the media, the raw materials, to manufacture its manifestations. The form of content of a brand is the level which accommodates the way in which the brand considers and positions itself vis-à-vis the conceptual universes in which it operates. This is where the brand asserts the way in which it structures its environment as a whole. It is where the brand defines its difference from its competitors. It is also where the singularity of any brand lies, where its philosophy, its vision of the world, or its relationship to others, both competitors and consumers, are deposited. In this stratum that Floch will end up calling the brand ethics, this is the stratum which is the hardcore of the brand. It is its stance. The brand ethics, in fact, gathers the conditions for a brand to belong to itself across time. And lastly, for the form of expression, this is the perceptible level where the specific sensitive attributes of a given brand appear. Its style, its cues, its clues, are located there, and they mark the brand production and endow them with a unique hand or a unique touch, with a sort of inimitable craftsmanship. Floch labels this stratum brand aesthetics, and it gathers the conditions for a brand to be recognized. So, for Floch, who was inspired by Paul Ricoeur's concept of narrative identity, the essence of a brand is both the stance and the style. That is to say, the articulation of an ethics with an aesthetics, both phrased in by definition united. So coming back to music, it is easy now to apply Floch's model, and we can easily say that music's ethics can be summarized by the notion of emptiness, considered as a reservoir of potentials, as we saw it, insofar as the musician places this concept of emptiness at the heart, not only of its design practice, but also of its relationship or interaction with its consumers and recipients in advertising. And symmetrically, we can also state that music aesthetics is characterized by the art of exformation, that is, the skill to carefully eliminate what's unnecessary from whatever embarks on, be it advertising, be it product design, be it packaging, and so on and so forth. So we can now have a closer look at one of these brand signs from which we started our journey to emptiness. This poster represents the Bolivian Unionist on tape that we now one that we saw at the beginning, and we can now look at it more precisely. The techniques media and raw materials that compose its substance of expression are obvious. We have a two-dimensional space, there is photography, there are words, typography, layout of different techniques, etc., etc. The universes in which music operates and that composes its substance of content are not only those of music's direct and indirect competitors, other retailers, or power brands, but it's also the world of advertising as a whole. It's a sense of the whole advertising as a whole. These substances are then taken charge of by the forms. The exploration of the substance of expression results in a pared down aesthetic side with no copy, no message, no tagline, no product shot, and as little information as possible. And this perceptible approach is the twin of Muji's conceptual status or conceptual ethics of emptiness, according to which it is up to the beholder to invent what Muji means, what Muji stands for, and in other words, to fill this empty vessel, as Kenny Hara calls it. At the end of the day, emptiness is about making space for the potential of a creative imagination of a recipient to flourish. And Kenny Hara puts it in a very simple way. Looking at this poster, he just said, well, there is nothing, and yet there is potentially everything. This analysis of the corporate campaign also applies to product campaigns. This is not a poster, this is a press ad. And because Kenny Hara has a lot of consideration for the broadcasters, that is for graphics and the prosthetics, he comes up with this kind of silent product advertising. This is a poster for a table, and it says nothing about the table. But very much like in their stores. In their stores, instead of naming the product with its intended purpose, like a coffee table, or dinner table, or kitchen table, or whatever, bedside table, Muji will prefer open-ended definitions, but they will say, this is an old table, full stop. This gives the client, the customer, the creative freedom to designate the table's ultimate purpose by himself. So I will briefly show you a few other examples of product campaigns. This is for a cupboard. This one is for foot mattresses. Here you have a series of filers. There are a series of pencils. And I want to dwell on this last one, which promotes the shelf. None of these ads, as you have seen, gives any information that just show products in a way that leaves full flexibility for the recipients to determine how they want to make use of them. And this is what conceptual emptiness is about. And as you have seen, the products are also shown in empty landscapes and backgrounds, so that the visuals sort of wake the beholder to that emptiness and trigger their imagination and creativity. They all give the recipients the freedom to develop their own way to assign a function to the object and eventually to mutually adjust to one another in a way which fully exploits their respective potentials. So for instance, this shelf, this piece of furniture here, may turn into a bookshelf, a bathroom or garage storage unit, a display case, a garderobe, etc., etc. It's now time to summarize and conclude. As an initial conclusion, we can state that the approach chosen by Muji to design, to market, to promote the objects that they manufacture, introduced a complete shift in the old world of standard marketing practice. It's a sort of rejuvenating change of paradigm. So we are here at the old marketing paradigm, so I'm not going to dwell too much on it. We'll see that. We've got subjects with expectations and wants. Then we have a manipulator which offers objects to be used which better meet these needs. And we finally end up with advertising that is based on careful strategies and sharp planning. So that's the old marketing paradigm. The new leg of the broadened marketing paradigm, the new leg that is introduced by Nguyen, is this one. So we can say that Nguyen plays the same game as the others. It is not, as I said, the fruit of a servitizing movement or an anti-globalization movement. No. Nguyen is a capitalistic enterprise which is to make profit. But although they play that game, they have infringed the rules. They have chosen another battleground, so to speak. They are not in search of certainty and safety as all the other marketers. They cultivate a sense of insecurity that borders hazard, as we saw. And this adventurism translates to the fact that they do not rely on assumptions about their customers' needs or their customers' wants, but they rely on their potential availability and their sensitivity. So they don't look for any superiority in their products, but they don't look for any greater affordance. On the contrary, they prefer less programmed products which are free of agenda, free of instructions. And exploration, so it allows them to come up with empty, practical products that are open-ended and therefore allow their users to develop and invent their own way to use them. And this is what we analyze in terms of adjustment. So this very same approach has led them, as we've seen, to develop this open-ended, empty type of communication whose content and meaning, again, has to be invented by the recipients. With this new paradigm, the question is the following. Is it still a question of, for the subjects to, is it still a question of choosing between more or less pre-programmed objects, or does the nature of the choice change? We can make the following assumption. This conception of marketing introduced by Nguyen in the general economy of finance cannot be reduced to a mere proposition of new objects on top of those already existing out there, but it can be understood as a proposition of a way of doing and thereby a way of being with and through these objects, or even beyond, as a way to experience them by practicing them. Whereby, in fact, instead of choosing things, one chooses oneself as a self. And this is what Eric Nagoski proposed to term a meta choice. So, basically, when it comes to making choices, the subject can rely on two elementary options. Either he listens to what others say, and to what uses, the norms, the opinions, or tastes prevailing around him tell him, and in that case, his identity and status have an exogenous origin, or, on the other hand, he can search for himself and by himself what the objects of his desire are, and trust his own experience and feelings in the direct presence of the objects, of the sensitive qualities of the external world, through the proprioceptive apprehension that his own senses allow. His identity and status, therefore, have an endogenous origin. So, On the other hand, in the standard grass cap, we find the figure of the Buddha, whose own plans have been anticipated by smart and shrewd marketers and designers, and who have conformed to the affordance of the objects that have been thought out in his set, and thereby finds himself programmed in his set, so we have a programmed program. Choosing these brands and being loyal to them is somehow equivalent to swearing allegiance to these brands, acknowledging them with a transcendent authority that they impose all the more easily as they do not even need to use force to do so. And in that sense, the definition of the ancient Roman clients, it is freely consented relation of subjection and fidelity to the autoritas of the noble benefactor, fully corresponds to that definition of the type of subject. So choosing this option allows to define oneself as a client in the most original, literal, and etymological sense of the term. On the other hand, in the account where we find the figure of the amateur, or the poacher, if we use Michel de Cerveau's precise terminology, who denies any form of authority, and therefore is the antithesis of the clients. The amateur is a free-spirited improviser who, as a poacher, to use again Michel de Cerveau's terminology, trespasses the fences of corporate rules, and as a maverick has a liking for transgressing the rules. He never, the poacher, never takes things at their face value, but interprets, or rather reinterprets them in his own way. He's somewhat of a resistant fighter to the system, if you will, and to him, any merchandise can be somehow turned into something that it was not intended for. So the amateur is also a pleasure seeker. His quest for singular sensory encounters, and conversely to the programmer, who is happy to be influenced and dictated what to do and what to be in reality, the amateur is a loose cannon. He's got open-mindedness, and his intrinsic sensibility and permanent availability to can happily accommodate such undetermined and empty object as Muji's products and Muji's advertising that impose nothing. But because they apparently have no precise usage or meaning, are therefore available for many, including and especially those of his own invention. So I will conclude now. At the end of the day, I think that Muji's success, in fact, teaches marketers a good lesson. Despite of its no-label ethos, it's just a pretense. It's a brand. It's a brand. It's a right. Muji behaves as a brand worthy of the name. Because if markets today are more and more saturated with products that are more and more undifferentiated and interchangeable, more and more insignificant, it is probably because standard brands have been sleeping on their laurels and have fallen into the insignificant routine of thought, like, you know, conforming to the question ways of working, mere repetition of proven successful recipes, and so on and so forth. So I want to finish this presentation with this quotation by a professor of marketing, a famous French professor of marketing, Benoît Blanc, who specializes writing in the study of brand management. And the quotation reads as follows: "A brand worthy of the name should not be reduced to mere prose of production. It should rather be considered from the angle of the poetics of creation, considering that creating has nothing to do with producing. A brand vision should creating possibilities, about liberating possibilities of life, capable of increasing both our power of sensitivity and our enjoyment of living. This is why a Brahman should absorb us in the order of life and not in that of representation. Is it not this aesthetic, ethical awakening of Brahmans that could constitute the possible last defense against the lurking disenchantment of our industrial economies? His last question raises another, which will end my presentation. Is this not precisely what Nyuchi does already, and rather successfully? Thank you very much.
Religion that
it's a very good question. They are not totally empty, of course. They are just a manifestation of emptiness. Should these posters be empty, completely empty? That is to say, completely white, with absolutely nothing, not even a brown logo, then this would fall into the trap of the risks that I mentioned about the designer's exclamation purpose. That is to say, that exclamation has a limit, which is to avoid falling into the unintelligible. So if these posters were completely black, with just white, a white surface with nothing on it and no logo, then it wouldn't be advertising anymore. So we would have fallen into the trap that I tried to mention by quoting Renard and by explaining that exclamation really has a limit. So it is something that I thought a lot about, and I believe that he tried to minimize what these posters represent, to really minimize, to optimize the mechanism of the posters, so they can still be looked at as advertising and not as a whiteboard. But yes, being advertising, conveying a sense of surprise, of emptiness, of a sense of what do I make of this? So there are two elements of answers. One is Shiko, with its beliefs in nature and kamis and in nature, and the other one is the limit of this exercise of exforming advertising. If we were to make it completely empty, would not be advertising anymore. So there's a minimal element that there's a minimal amount of elements that have to be there to just say this is advertising, but nothing else. So this is what emptiness is in advertising terms. But I could have shown you other examples of emptiness without nature. So, a few years later, there was a campaign about homes. The campaign showed empty apartments. Not finished. With concrete on the walls and pipes all over the place. So this is really the limit. Did you get a loop? Oh, okay, fine.
It's not probably a question, but a remark. You spoke just about the objects for the men, one kind of objects, not in the semantic sense, in the ordinary sense. But all what you said might be applied to subjects. I mean, in the ordinary language, persons, others. Because persons, just as the objects, for instance, the chair, there is a person here, this person, just as this object here, is socially thematized, defined, characterized. This is a chair, this is the participant to the conference. And a lot of determination are pre-existence. This person has spectacles, he wears such and such clothes and so on. So this chair is meant to sit, it is comfortable or not. So the process that Mouji invites us to do is to somehow forget, put aside all so to predeterminations of the objects.
Yes.
Of chairs and everything. But we could extend this and invite people, not being mushy, but being, I don't know quite exactly, and invite people to put aside, get rid of all determinations that we have in mind about persons, and try to view these things that which we call persons as empty.
Yes.
And then, instead of being in relation with, for instance, a teacher, a woman, maybe a Lithuanian, maybe a teacher, maybe I don't know what, in conversation, we, at the beginning of the meeting, we meet and we say, we introduce, I am from France, I am a musician, oh no, I am a musician. Instead of that, to try and enter in relationship with the minimum existence of this thing, which is a person,
freed from
all these labels which our social existence invites us to put on
people, right?
And then this is that, of course, it would not be emptiness completely, because it is necessary that there be a partner. But this partner reduced to a very, very, very little determination would permit each other in the relationship to develop an interaction which would not be programmed by programmers, that is to say, by society. We would be with the possibility of letting the potential of each other in the relationship grow, develop in a way which is not pre-established by anything. So we would create something together, and this would be perfect adjustment and liberty, as you say, the creation of a human and so on. But there must be, it is problematic, but it is necessary that there be a partner, an interaction, that is with something, someone, with the less determination as possible, so that it must be reciprocal, especially in intersubjective relationships, to create a new subjectivity, which is interactively created, starting from almost nothing.
Yes.
Like an extension of Bougie.
Si je me permets mon rôle de président, je veux dire que ce que tu proposes était déjà fait en philosophie par Levinas, quand on parle de l'éthique et quand on essaie d'écrire en quoi l'autre est différent de sujet ordinaire, éthique ou quelconque, écrit dans les rapports ordinaires. Donc, propose la même chose sur le plan, la même chose sur le plan éthique, ce que tu proposes.
It's not a very simple question, but I'm just curious if you have any comments. Is there any relationship between the time and the successfulness of Muji brand, especially right here, like right at this and maybe we have a certain time when this I think you can call it even a trend of emptiness started, and how and is there a time when it will end, do you think? And because I've noticed that there's a trend of this emptiness, and I can notice that in Lithuanian products and in general, and I'm just curious if there's some kind of a relations with time. Mm.
I haven't really thought about it, but it's probably very likely. I mean, there is a moment when our economic, capitalistic system is coming to an end. I mean, it's saturated. As a freelance marketing consultant, I work a lot with manufacturers, with brands, and more and more products launched, rolled out on the market, just look like other products. I mean, there's, as I said, markets are saturated by undifferentiated products, which are being undifferentiated are more and more insignificant. Therefore, brands have not managed to do their jobs properly. So it was probably not intentional from UG, but what they proposed sort of echoed a fatigue by consumers. Consumers are just bored to death. I mean, when you have to choose between three or four shampoos based on the same honeysuckle or based on the same flavor or herb, I mean, what's the point? I mean, they are all the same. So there's probably a notion, an explanation linked to present times. But of course, I also think that what I presented is interesting per se, independently of any circumstances. Yeah. But the circumstances worked probably very much in favour of Muji's policy. That could be hypothesized. Yes, very much so.
Dėkosiu pranešėjai ir tie, kurie galbūt spalvos klausimo kokiu nors ar šiaip pamastymu, galėsiu jo pasidaryti ant iškėvos vaikakalnio. Primenu, kad šiandien yra išnuomotas autobusas, pusės 7, vyksime į iškėvos vaikakalnį, tada prieš tai nuo 3 valandos vyks diskusijos apie kitą labai įdomų, tuščią ir tiksliau ištuštintą, kad dar nepripildytą objektą Lukiškių aikštę.
Your mic
yes.
Back.
Yes. You mentioned that one. Just quickly mention.